All right, we're in C++ world again. Who are you, sir?
So my name is Andy Ayers. I'm one of the architects on the Phoenix project, which is part of the C++ team. And Phoenix is an ambitious framework for doing code generation and code analysis.
Okay.
So we have been working on Phoenix for a number of years. We're at the point now where we're really looking to get the stuff out there into people's hands. We're not quite ready to say when we're going to ship, but we're sort of on that threshold of being ready.
Cool.
And so we expect that we should be able to announce some stuff, coming up in the not-too-distant future about when we're going to be out there. But in the meantime, we do ship our stuff out as a publicly available download from Connect. That's called Phoenix Software Development Kit that anybody can go download.
Now, the last time we talked about Phoenix was with Jim Hogg, who's, I guess, now moved on to the SQL team.
Yes.
There's a lot of C++ going on there, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked basically, it was in the time frame of the RDK.
Right.
And now you're saying there's actually an SDK.
Yeah, I mean, you could think of it as just sort of a change of name, but really it's more of a change of emphasis. When we had the RDK, when Phoenix started, it was really a partnership with Microsoft Research. And the RDK was primarily driven to meet the needs of researchers and academics. And Phoenix has a broader audience than that. Even though it's a very specialized toolkit, there's a bunch of practitioners in industry and other places that could take advantage of it. Mm-hmm. So when we took control over the distribution, we renamed it to the SDK to sort of emphasize it is a broader audience of people that we're looking for. We're not just appealing to researchers. We're now appealing to people who have businesses who want to do language analysis, program analysis, and transformation, and they can start experimenting with Phoenix to see how it's going to fit in their future product plans, things like that.
Excellent. So let's dig in a little bit here. I mean, you're an architect. Tell us, what is Phoenix exactly?
At the heart of Phoenix really is a representation for a program, which we call Phoenix IR. Mm. And it sort of lies at the core of everything that we do. And it's just a really detailed description of what the program is attempting to do. And we like to think of Phoenix as a really good form for analysis because all of the manipulation of things in Phoenix IR is explicit in the IR. Let me give you an example to tell you what that means. If you look at something like MSIL, when you look at an MSIL instruction, you can't necessarily understand what it does without modeling the state of the MSIL program stack at that point. So you'll look at MSIL, and there'll just be an opcode like add, and it won't say what the inputs to the add are or where the output is supposed to go. Those things are left implicit. It's implied that you take them from the stack and you put the result back on the stack.
Mm.
So when you look at two instructions in MSIL, it's very difficult for you to say how they're connected to one another without going through a detailed simulation of the stack behavior from one point to another. So although it does describe what the program does, the description is implicit in the model that the machine uses to execute instructions. And Phoenix, on the other hand, if this guy produces an input to this guy, there's a direct connection between one and the other. So it's very easy to sort of trace through these things and do what we would call a data flow analysis and say, how does the value produced here get consumed later on in the program?
Hmm.
All that stuff is just laid out right there in the IR for any tool to sort of walk around and take advantage of.
So, I mean, is IR sort of like an abstract syntax tree?
It's not quite a tree. It's not a tree structure. It's a linear structure.
Okay.
One of the reasons we prefer the linear structure is that it makes the flow of control in the program readily apparent. And it's sort of, if you think about an abstract syntax tree, you're going to have a node in there for something like a for loop or a while loop. And that encodes the fact that there's a certain amount of control flow that's embedded in there. We sort of flatten all the control flow structures down just to simple tests and go-tos, effectively.
Mm.
So when we see a for loop, we see a test, and then we see a conditional branch, and then we see some labels in the code that tell us where everything goes. Everything gets sort of lowered down into that common form. And while it may seem like it loses information, it actually gives us a general expressive power that now all you need to understand are sort of these basic set of constructs and you can analyze any program. So we call that a linear form.
Mm.
It's traditionally the kind of thing that you see. If you watch a program sort of flow through the compiler, originally it will have a tree structure that will sort of model the program syntax, but eventually it will get flattened down and linearized and then turned into machine code as it makes its way out the other end.
Excellent.
So that's what the IR looks like. And it's also good because if we have exception handling constructs in the code. One of the emphases in Phoenix actually is doing a really faithful job of modeling exceptional behavior. And it's important for a couple reasons. One is that in C++, as you may know, exceptions can happen at all sorts of points in the program.
Mm-hmm.
The optimizer of the program analysis tool has to be aware of when those can happen and what they might mean. The other one is that we know that exceptional behavior is often behavior that's difficult for people to test or difficult to reason about. And there's a lot of bugs that only come up in exception handling paths that are very hard to root out. Mm-hmm. We'd like to give analysis tools the ability to sort of drill in on those and understand those just as well as the rest of the program so that these bugs that are hard to test for can be found by analysis tools.
Very interesting.
And give people, you know, a heads up that way.
But I would, you know, I think sort of at the surface that seems a little bit contradictory, or not contradictory isn't the right word, but kind of hard to wrap your head around, because exceptions are exceptional mm-hmm. things
yeah.
by design, by
yeah.
definition. Sometimes you'll throw them on purpose, but let's yeah. talk about that.
So the compiler, in some sense, is kind of like the ultimate paranoid thing, right? It has to worry about everything that might possibly happen, even though in practice most of these things never, ever do happen. And so exceptions are one example. If the language says that it's possible for an exception to be thrown at this point in the program, the compiler has to assume that it could happen.
Sure.
And so we have to prepare for it, and we have to produce correct code in the possibility that it does happen. Just like a more common example is if you are writing a program that has what we call aliasing in it, so you have a bunch of pointers, the compiler has to assume that all of your pointers may point at all the things that they could possibly point to. And even though in practice when you run the program, it's very difficult for you to reason about a program with a lot of aliasing, and programmers tend not to introduce this intentionally, the compiler doesn't know that. It has to make the most conservative assumption possible. And so when I say it's kind of paranoid, it has to be worried about all these things that might happen. And, you know, in some sense, it's kind of a bummer that you have to do this, because it really limits some of the things you could do to transform the program. On the other hand, we don't always know what the user's intention is when they write the code. All we know is how they express their intention in the programming language, and we have to respect whatever the semantics of that are when we do our analysis, when we do our code generation.
Interesting. Now, with Phoenix, because it's pluggable, it's extensible, mm-hmm. right? It's a framework. You guys
right.
have an API. Am I able to, you know, increase or decrease the level of paranoia?
There are ways to do that. So I'll give you an example where we see this. So a lot of times when you write a static analysis tool, if the static analysis tool was as paranoid as the code generator was, it would generate a lot of false warnings for things that are extremely unlikely to ever happen, but could happen, right? Mm-hmm. So what you might want to do when you're running your analysis tool is basically tell our framework, you know, be optimistic. Don't be so concerned about things. And, you know, you can make reasonable assumptions that aliasing doesn't happen, that exceptions are not as common as they might be, and see what conclusions you arrive at when you do that. And then maybe go ahead and be fully pessimistic and see what conclusions you arrive at when you do that. If those two set of conclusions are vastly different, then you might be worried that this code would be prone to reporting false positives for it. You know, you might warn about a problem that would never, ever actually happen. You know, there's this limitation in static analysis that you can't know what the program is actually going to do when you run it. You have to make assumptions, and giving our users the ability to make optimistic assumptions sometimes gives them a better quality result, with the guarantee now that you may not find all of the bugs that could be in the code. So you sort of have to give up one thing in order to get another. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be complete, you're going to be noisy. You don't want to be noisy, then you can't be complete. But
sure,
most users will sort of settle for that trade-off. They'd rather see a bunch of bugs that are pretty likely and pretty real than a set of bugs which, you know, may never happen, and then embedded in there are a small number that are the ones they have to worry about. So that's one of the arts of getting a static analysis right, is really sort of walking that line between telling everybody everything that could be wrong and telling them the ones that they should focus on that matter.
Very cool.
And so, you know, it's a challenge that teams like the FXCop team or the Prefast / Analyze team have to deal with all the time.
So let's talk a little bit about the relationship. I mean, clearly there's an obvious relationship between a compiler framework and static analysis, but it's not necessarily the case. So let's talk about, so the Phoenix can generate code.
Mm-hmm.
It can generate IL, well, which is code, but it can
right.
generate C++, right, front end.
We don't generate source code out of Phoenix.
You can't generate source code.
Well, I wouldn't say you can't.
Optimize source code.
We don't. It's probably possible for you to regenerate a program which is equivalent to the program we read in. It may not look anything like the original program, right? Because we won't know whether the sequence of go-tos and labels was a while or a for or whatever. But it could be probably a valid program.
Okay.
We haven't invested any energy in doing that kind of thing. People usually call it like decompilation or something. We haven't worked on that much.
That's cool. So then let's talk about what exactly do you produce.
Okay. So our main target is still machine code. So
okay.
the main use of Phoenix and the use within the group that's predominant is to take source programs and compile them all the way down to either x86 or x64 or other machine codes. And that's kind of our bread and butter, and that's what the group here was originally chartered to do long ago. It's historically been that code generation group. And so we probably focus, you know, the majority of our people's effort on trying to do that and trying to do that really well. And, you know, we have big demanding customers using our stuff, building their products using Phoenix, you know, asking us to make sure that they get the level of performance out of their code that they need. And, you know, this is a long-standing problem of how you generate optimal code or even good code for various constructs. And you know, it's something we spend a lot of our time working on.
Sure.
That part.
So in terms of, so basically, I mean, I understand it's a compiler, and you feed a compiler source code, and it actually turns it into constructs that the machine understands that run appropriately and in some case, you know, hopefully are secure.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So that's where the analysis comes in. So, for example, if I give you a bunch of C++ code and I throw it into the Phoenix compiler,
right,
and I say, all right, analyze this for buffer overruns and any other stupid mistakes that I make, and then spit out the right machine code. That will work? And
yeah.
It could just go through a filter that I provide in the analysis context?
So because of the plugin model, you have the ability, if you, the example I like to say is, suppose that one day your boss comes to you and he says, you know, recursion is a bad idea. I don't want you to ever use recursive algorithm anywhere in your code. I'm outlawing it, I'm banishing it. You might laugh, but it turns out we effectively do that in our own code just because you eventually recursion, you run into a case where this, you know, the stack overflows, and no matter how careful you are, it's just too hard to manage. So, you know, a normal compiler isn't going to tell you you're using an unapproved algorithm. Recursion is perfectly legal within the language, everything is fine. But with Phoenix, you could come along and you could write a compiler plugin and add it right in, drop it in, it could analyze the code, detect a recursive invocation and functions, and then issue a compiler warning just like any other warning saying, you know, I found recursion in here. The rules of our build don't allow recursion, so I'm going to break the build at this point, and that would stop, you know, developers on your team from introducing recursion into your code. So it's possible to start taking some of these, what we would sort of call architectural or other practices, and start embedding our tools with the ability to enforce those when you do the when you do your development. It's been our experience that when you have these things and you don't have a tool to enforce it, people find ways of sort of sneaking it in there. So it's really nice to have something which is, you know, something that you can't avoid going through in order to check whether you're following the rules that the group has agreed on and the way they're going to develop their code.
Absolutely.
So we see a lot, you know, potentially that this could, somebody could come along and they could read Herb Sutter's book or one of these other great books about here's the right way to write C++, codify a lot of that stuff, create, you know, sort of stylistic plugins, put them right into their code base, into the compiler, and then their code would be, you know, protected against violating any of those rules and things like that.
That would be excellent. And I guess the other thing that could be very interesting would be to have a component, sort of a parallelism component, where I could write in a static analysis tool that could tell me as a developer, hey man, you're not really taking your code assumes that you're always going to be running on one core. Bad idea. I mean, this is sort of, we're going into a little bit of science fiction, but I know that theoretically, could be possible to do something like that.
Yeah, it's always been the dream to have language tools be really good at notifying programmers about the ability to parallelize their code. People have worked on this for a long time, and you know they have made some progress in some areas. The general purpose solution to that remains elusive, and it's, you know, a lot of people are skeptical that something like that can be found. But things like that you can certainly pick up on, right? So the program might be able to say, "I'm expecting this code to be parallelizable." And then the analysis could kick in and say, well, I'm sorry, but you know, I'm unable to show that that's safe for the following reason, and maybe guide the programmer into re-expressing their code in a way that the tool can now demonstrate can be parallelized. And so you can sort of get that kind of feedback loop going. The general purpose case, probably too hard. I know I wouldn't hold my breath waiting for something like that to pop out.
Sure.
But in certain program domains where the programmer can make his intent clear, then those are things that are doable.
Now, as you're probably well aware, although you do live in the C++ world, something that's really popular right now in this, the age of Web 2.0, are dynamic languages. And so is there some sort of notion of a Phoenix kind of runtime jitter
Well, we haven't done a whole lot with technologies that run alongside the program. When we initially built Phoenix, and we actually still have this capability today, we can produce a JIT that works with the CLR. The JIT was never good enough for us to seriously consider pushing that as the production JIT. But sort of the underlying idea of generating code is kind of the same. We've had some people do various experiments where they used Phoenix as a JIT in very specialized circumstances. I can give you sort of one example. We had a guy on the SQL team who experimented with optimizing SQL expression, I think it was expression analysis, by analyzing the expression that was in the SQL query and then custom generating native code off on the side to execute that and then jumping into that code. So it's a specialized kind of JIT. And those kind of things might actually be interesting for people to play with. But the challenge with writing a JIT is that the code generator is now in the process or alongside the user's code. Places a lot of demands on the code generator to behave itself and not, you know, crash or have memory leaks or other things. And there's usually some threading and reentrancy demands, and those are fairly challenging standards to live up to. And I'm not sure that our code is sort of radiation hardened for that kind of thing. But it's a fun place to play around. So
absolutely,
yeah.
So you mentioned radiation hardened. I mean, from what I've been reading about Phoenix, at least in the literature, from the research perspective. Is that really the plan, is to have this be the de facto compiler for
Absolutely.
Everything we do?
Yeah.
So can it scale to, like, compile successfully something like Windows or Office?
Yeah. You know, part of our value to the community is to provide people with a really robust tool set. It's been our intention from the beginning that Phoenix would be a technology that we would share with external users, but also use it internally in our own products. And so we currently are using Phoenix to build Windows as a test case. And, you know, it's been very interesting for us. It's been very challenging. The Windows code base is big. It's complicated. It takes us a number of hours to build the thing from source and produce the binaries. But, you know, we sort of view that as kind of a real proving ground for whether we're ready for prime time or not. It's been a tradition at Microsoft that no compiler ever ships unless it's been able to successfully build Windows and a number of other products, SQL and Visual Studio itself and a couple others. And so we're sort of working our way through that set of big code bases. We call it real-world code.
Interesting.
In order to demonstrate that the compiler is really ready, that it's been baked enough, that it, you know, the bugs have been shaken out. And so it's been complicated, but it's been well worth it to do that.
Excellent. So let's talk just a little bit about, I mean, the C++ team has always, you know, written basically the compiler that all product teams use if they're writing unmanaged code or native code, excuse me. And so what I would ask is, beyond being a framework and pluggable, extensible, which of course is very interesting in and of its own right, what is the value add in terms of an evolutionary perspective from, you know, compilation? So basically what I'm trying to blurt out here is, how is Phoenix better than our current compiler that you guys use? So from a compilation standpoint.
Right. I think there's a couple different dimensions to it. One is that the Phoenix compiler internally is multi-threaded. So we're sort of, you know, we sort of see ourselves in the vanguard of being ready for multi-core coming onto the desktop. So we know that one of the things developers hate to do is sit there and wait for a build to complete. We took it upon ourselves to make Phoenix be able to exploit as many cores as there are on the machine.
Nice.
And so, just to give an example, when we build Windows kernel is about, I don't know, 700, 800 source files that get linked together. And inside there, there's maybe 10 or 11,000 functions that need to be compiled. We're able to compile those functions individually, concurrently. And so on a machine with 8 processors, the build goes about 5 times faster than it does on a machine with 1 processor. So instead of waiting a minute to build the kernel, it completes in about 22 seconds or something like that.
Excellent.
Maybe that's not quite 5 times faster, but the numbers work out.
Certainly.
They do it for real. So that's one value that we have. Another is that because we've got the plug-in model and we were talking about ways you could extend the compiler with analysis, you can also extend the compiler with new transformation opportunities. One of the ways that we think we can take advantage of this is that whenever new hardware emerges, it always takes us a little while to adapt the compiler to exploit the new hardware instructions, right? So, you know, Intel and AMD have just announced a whole new set of extension instructions for you know, streaming Cindy, I think version 4, version 4A, and things like that. That you have to wait for us to sort of get around to incorporating that knowledge into our compiler and shipping it out. It might be 2 years before you can use our toolset to use those instructions. So our expectation that once Phoenix comes out, when a hardware developer produces a new chip, they'll also supply a compiler plugin for a Phoenix compiler that will immediately allow Phoenix to generate those new instructions.
Excellent.
So that sort of time to take advantage of new hardware, you know, in sort of a mainstream supported way, should go down dramatically.
Excellent.
So we're kind of excited about that, and I think that our hardware partners are also excited because they're no longer sort of locked into our schedules to figure out when people can really make use of their stuff. And then Phoenix also has the ability not only to generate code, but to take already generated code and pull it back up into our intermediate representation. It's a process we call binary raising, or reading a portable executable file. And it comes back into that same format. And so all the tools that you write that work on Phoenix IR work perfectly well whether you're working in a compilation context or whether you're working in a binary raising context. So if you write a security analysis tool, for example, you can plug it into the compiler on one side, catch errors that are in new code that's, you know, going on during the build. You can also go analyze your legacy binaries and, using the exact same technology, look for the errors in the code that you've already built. And so that kind of flexibility doesn't exist in the current compiler at all.
That's outstanding.
There's probably more stuff, but that's kind of the main things.
Sure. So I guess one of the things that really interests me, because in essence, a compiler deals with a lot of data, right? That's what, you could look at code as data.
Right.
Is machine learning.
Okay.
I mean, has there been any work done where people have written, machine learning analysis tools that over time learn? I mean, for example, if you look at the Windows code base, there's a lot of stuff in there that's been there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And is there some sort of pattern recognition analysis tool that could be written that targets specific code bases? I don't know if my question makes sense, but I think it does.
Well, there's a couple things that come to mind with that. One is that a common problem in a lot of big code bases is what people call the cut-and-paste problem. Mm-hmm. So it's been my experience that developers always find, like, the worst piece of code to copy. But what will happen is that a particular code idiom will sort of start to spread around through a code base over time. Because, you know, there's many people who have to solve similar problems. They'll find a piece of code that solves that problem or something close to it, make a copy of it, and maybe customize it a little bit. Next guy comes along, he makes another copy. One of the big challenges is, now let's suppose we discover a security vulnerability in that original piece of code. Okay. Well, we may be able to identify it and fix it, but now how do we find all of these sort of clones of this thing? And they may not be exact copies, they may be near copies. How do we find code that looks like this somewhere else in the code base? This is a challenging problem. And so you can write a tool which basically will do pattern matching in the code space or in the Phoenix IR, and then again use the raising tool or the compiling tool to start looking around. Is there other code out there that happens to look like this?
Excellent.
Probably remember we introduced the secure CRT in Visual Studio 2005, right? And we took away a lot of functions that were considered unsafe, like, you know, strcat or something like that. And we replaced them with secure versions, and that was great. And we scrubbed through our code base, and we said, developers, you can no longer use these functions. They lead to security issues. They're not safe. But, you know, we have a lot of clever people here. And the guy says, you know, I really need to do strcat. I can't call the function. Well, it's not that hard for me to write one myself. Let me just go code up my own little version of strcat. Right? So now we've been sort of introduced another kind of clone, which is somebody has reproduced a code pattern, which we thought, you know, we shouldn't allow in the code base. So again, you want to be able to scan through and say, did somebody write something which sort of follows this kind of pattern that we don't think we should allow in our code? So those kinds of things you can do as well.
Interesting.
And then the other thing that comes to mind is when we go to do performance tuning on the compiler, the goal is for our compiler to produce the best binary possible, most efficient. This is a complicated problem. People have been studying it for a long time. We often will think about using, I don't know if it's exactly machine learning, but some of the same ideas of being able to do a big set of experiments and then look at those observations and gain insight from that pool of data, possibly using various automated algorithms to do that. And then maybe close the feedback loop and be able to sort of iterate through there and try to drive the compiler into a higher and higher level of performance, you know, through an automated process like that.
Excellent. So I guess one of the things that came to mind while you were describing that was, what if, you know, I'm writing some code, and some of the code I'm writing is, if it were publicly exposed, you know, such that user input could send data down to this chunk of code, mm-hmm. then there could be security issues. Mm-hmm. But what if it was 100% private, doing some really nasty stuff, I needed to just eke out every bit of performance that I could?
Right.
Your pattern analysis could strip me of that code, because I could argue as a developer that, hey, wait a minute, no one is ever going to call this function.
Yeah. Right.
And I know it may look insecure to you. I'm never going to get data from a user. I'm never going to, you know... So it's a complicated question, but how could I tweak the analysis that, hey, ignore this purely private kind of insanity that I'm doing in my engine?
Yeah. I think there's a couple of ways to solve it. One is, we have a general annotation facility. Basically, you could put an annotation on here that says, hey, compiler, I'm an expert. Trust me. I promise nothing bad is ever going to happen.
And then
we have stuff that happens like that, right? But what we like to say is sort of trust but verify. So we'll say, okay, we see that you claim that this function can never be called and passed any sort of untrusted piece of data. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we can also do interprocedural data flow analysis, and we can try to model all the ways that data can make its way down through the code into your algorithm. Mm-hmm. If we ever discover that this claim that you made, that you could ever be called this way, is false, mm-hmm. then, we're not going to trust you anymore. We're going to say, sorry, you've made this assumption. We don't think it's true. Here's the reason why. Mm-hmm. So you sort of can kind of get the best of both of us. We'll trust you, but we'll also double check and make sure that there's no obvious flaw in your assertion that your code is okay.
Outstanding.
So those kinds of things are certainly doable. And we expect annotations to probably be a bigger and bigger role going forward. But again, it's hard to express the programmer's intent just with the pure programming language, so you need some extra stuff sometimes.
Unless, of course, they're writing functional. Because by definition, a functional language is you should be able to understand what the function is going to do before it ever executes.
Yes. There's all different levels of intent, right? We can understand what the programmer meant for the program to do. We may not understand why the programmer wanted the program to do that particular thing.
Okay.
Right? So in general, the compiler, the compiler isn't particularly smart in a lot of ways. It's basically, it's got some sophisticated algorithms, but like I said, it's basically sort of paranoid and worried about lots of things that might go wrong, and trying to balance off all sorts of trade-offs and make trade-offs for situations where it can't possibly know what the right answer is.
Mm-hmm.
You give me an if-then-else. I don't know whether the then part or the else part is more important to you. Maybe they're both important. Mm-hmm. Maybe you want this one to be small. Maybe you want this one to be fast. There's many different concerns that can come in there, and I could generate all kinds of different code depending upon what your intent was. And even if you told me what your intent was today, a year from now, people might be using your code differently than you thought, and maybe it would shift. So what we really like to recommend that people do is rely on what we call our profile-guided optimization framework, or PGO, where we allow the compiler to observe the program running through an instrumentation phase and feed that information back in so we can sort of see how the code is actually being used rather than how you said it was actually being used.
Hmm.
And we use that right now for optimization. In the future, we may be able to use it to sort of hone analysis as well and say, this part of the code is heavily used, we should spend more time analyzing it, or whatever the case may be.
Outstanding. So let's talk a little bit about the managed world, because of course,
sure.
In C++ land, you guys have had to do a lot of work,
right,
to support the CLR and the whole managed revolution.
Yeah.
How are managed types using Phoenix framework?
So Phoenix IR is basically powerful enough to represent both native code and managed code at the same time. Mm-hmm. And what was part of our goal was to, internally inside of Phoenix, to kind of blur the distinction. In other words, once it becomes Phoenix IR, we don't particularly care whether it represents native code or managed code. We try to sort of represent it all the same way.
Mm.
So we have a type system in Phoenix which is powerful enough to represent both managed types and unmanaged types at the same time. We have IR that can represent both managed operations and unmanaged operations. All of that stuff can sort of play nicely together. And because it's all lowered into this common format, your analysis tool doesn't necessarily have to be focused on whether I'm analyzing or it's analyzing native code or managed code either.
Oh, interesting.
And so actually one of the nice things we get is that there's a lot of tools out there that try to work with what we call mixed mode binaries. So part of the binary is managed, part of the binary is native. They'll sort of fall down because they're either good at one or they're good at the other, but they kind of can't cross the bridge.
Mm.
In Phoenix, we don't particularly care. It's code. it's expressed this way or expressed that way, it doesn't matter to us. But doing mixed mode analysis is something that is basically no trouble for us at all.
Very cool.
And then native binaries tend to be more challenging to raise up. Managed binaries are relatively straightforward because they're self-descriptive, they have metadata. So we have a very strong ability to take a managed binary, raise it up into IR, and do all sorts of analysis, and possibly even transformation. Whereas a native, sometimes things are a little more challenging. Mm. The native binaries are more brittle, they're harder to manipulate. You can still do it, but it's just more challenging.
Absolutely. So do you do, when you optimize, you know, if I tell you to optimize my code, I mean, isn't that what, in the managed world, that's what the jitter does for me at runtime, right? So it's going to say, okay, let's take all this, flatten this, this is what you really want to do, this is going to run faster. So do you do that for me in Phoenix before? So in other words, I compile my code in Phoenix, and then the JIT's going to get already good MSIL, right?
Yeah.
I mean, let's talk a little bit about that.
So there's been some talk. We haven't done a lot of work, but there's been some talk on doing what we would call MSIL to MSIL optimization.
Nice.
Okay. And I give you a simple example of something we saw. It's kind of like what we talked about before. Users may not realize that in the C++ or the CLR provides an efficient way of doing something, and they may code up something on their own that's not as efficient. The example we actually saw was people would code up the C++ equivalent of an array copy by copying an array element one by one, right? And the CLR provides you with some high-speed primitives that you just go and call, and they make these things happen, right? So the JIT is not going to sort of look at your code and say, hey, I see what you're doing here. You're copying this whole array. Let me just turn it into this. Because the JIT typically doesn't have time to do that kind of in-depth analysis of your code. Its goal is to produce as good of code as it can as quickly as possible and then sort of get out of the way. But if you're operating ahead of time and you're working on an MSIL to MSIL transformation, you could very easily look through there and say, oh, I see what's going on here. The user is using a very inefficient idiom to express this transformation. Let me replace it for him with a more efficient one. We saw some cases where we'd see switch statements that had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of switch arms, and it turned out that you could re-optimize them into if-then-else trees or something very efficiently. And those kinds of things that require a little bit more introspection, you might want to do ahead of time to basically precondition the MSIL so that when you go to JIT it, then the JIT can do what it does. So there's some room there. Mm-hmm. We haven't played too much in that space, but I think some people have looked at it a little bit.
That's cool. I mean, so I think that would be a very interesting space because a lot of, you know, it's easy to write malperformant, if that's even a word, managed code if you don't understand really what's going on with how the garbage collector works and what's really going on with your code.
Yeah.
So it would be nice to get.
I don't know if we can fix those kinds of problems that are really, for example, you know, a classic problem is somebody wants to build up a really long string and they just keep calling string append over and over and over again. This is probably like the number one performance issue that comes up in managed code a lot. You might be able to write a style guide that says, gee, it looks like you're appending to a string a lot. That's probably a bad idea. Automatically transforming that code into something more efficient might be harder. And I don't want to claim that we can do that, but we might be able to tell you seem to be using practices which we wouldn't recommend.
Okay.
So at least we can get the programmer back in the game and give them a chance to respond and, you know, fix the issue on their side.
Well, in that case, that would be because of the notion that a string is immutable, right? So you'd be making new copies of it every single
time. Yeah.
But there is something you could use. It's called the... It's a class.
String buffer?
Yeah, it's a class that you can actually call that you just run. It takes care of the nonsense for you.
Yeah, so that would probably be the recommendations. The analysis tool would say, I see you, you know, appending to strings a lot. Have you considered maybe you should be using string buffer instead?
Mm-hmm.
And then we could point you right at the documentation or the note in the MSDN that says, here's why you want to avoid doing this. Here's why this is good.
Cool.
So, again, you can't necessarily automate everything, but if you can point the programmer at the right spot in the code and give them the information, then they can figure out how to fix things, then that's almost as good.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's really what makes development tools like Visual Studio really useful to developers, right?
Yeah. Our goal is, you know, make programmers be more productive, more powerful, more capable by having the tools be in there helping them out as much as they can.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And then allowing the tools, the developers, to actually write compilation-level tools that help them and their fellow employees write better code.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So right now, this is still sort of a researchy kind of targeted project. You guys are a very small team, so it's not really something that you'd want to support with millions of people using. Because developers, I know, at Channel 9 are going to ask, hey, man, can I use this?
Yeah.
So the answer would be it's publicly downloadable, but you're a small team, right?
We provide support sort of on a best faith effort. But we, you know, we try as hard as we can. If people are coming across problems that we know how to solve, then obviously we'll go out and help solve them. We tend to release Phoenix about once every 6 months, although we've been kind of bad, and it's been about 9 months since our last release. But we're just about to put one out. Probably by the time this thing makes it out there, we'll have a new release up on our site.
Excellent.
But, you know, what we tend to do is instead of servicing that, we'll just say, well, you're just going to have to wait until we ship another one. And we expect to be able to produce that with that same sort of frequency, 6 months, maybe even a little more frequently, shipping things out until we finally make it into an official release. I don't know exactly when that's going to be. We are still looking at opportunities in the next version of Visual Studio, and it's not clear what's going to happen there yet. But, you know, sometime around there or later,
sure,
we should be out for real.
Absolutely.
And we'll be called something else. But
because this is, again, another cool name that we
can
use.
That's right.
It'll probably be called the Microsoft Compilation System Framework Services.
Something like that. And then we'll have to have a cool acronym.
I hope so.
That would pull out of that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, in Vista, there's Superfetch.
Right.
Hey, actually a cool name for something that does something interesting.
Yeah.
So maybe you guys, hopefully they'll come up with a cool name. You hear that, marketing? C++ team has pretty cool marketing, though. There are marketing people here.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of discussion on what the name could be. In fact, probably a lot more than one would imagine. It warrants that kind of discussion, but it's a favorite topic to sort of get, you know, bogged down in at some point.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Cool. Well, hey, it's been great talking to you.
Sure.
And love to come and see how this thing evolves, especially when it becomes the compiler of choice around the company.
All right. You have time for a quick demo? Can I demo?
All right, so demo.
Yeah, so I thought I'd show one demo, which is kind of an interesting and unusual application of Phoenix. So here we have a really simple program that we're running, and we're down here at this breakpoint, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we notice above the breakpoint there was an if-then-else. And, you know, these variables have a value like sum is equal to 2 and total is equal to 0. But maybe we don't remember, or we need to know in order to understand this bug how we got down there. So what we've done with Phoenix is we've added in a new menu option through a Visual Studio package that we've added in that includes Phoenix to do what we call a dynamic slice of the program. So I'm going to select this variable sum right here. And I'm going to click this select slice option, and Phoenix goes off, analyzes the binary, analyzes this function, figures out how control got to that point in the function, and then works backwards through the control flow and the data flow to figure out which statements contributed to the sum having its current value.
Nice.
And then we highlight those in the UI. So we can see that sum has the value 2. The way it got the value 2 was it got a copy of the value from y, which happened to be 2. The reason we went down there is because x's value is 1, and so we went down through that time. And this value, sum being set to 0, didn't impact its current value, but it did contribute to, you know, the slice.
Outstanding.
And then we can do the same thing with this other variable, total. We see here total wasn't set in here, so it has its value come from way up there. And so this is known as program slicing, and here's an adaptation where Phoenix is now running inside of Visual Studio and communicating with the debugger. So it's kind of a cool thing that that may not be obvious that you can do this kind of thing. This is program analysis, right? It's just
Absolutely.
Exactly the same kind of thing the compiler does, just applied in different contexts of helping the user understand, you know, how their program is behaving in the debugger.
Absolutely. So, now let me ask you this. If the control flow is going through, so if I'm writing an application where I'm using a compiled binary as part of my solution, and I don't have the source code to it, you would show me the disassembly. You'd show me what from the, because you won't have the symbols.
Yeah. So our ability to understand binaries is really limited to those binaries for which you have the symbolic debug information.
Sure.
Right? So if you've got third party binaries and they haven't shared with you these symbolic debug files, then our ability to analyze those binaries is really limited, and we don't tell you much about them at all. So, you know, it's not, this isn't total solution. This isn't, we're not shipping it as part of the product yet because, you know, we have these kind of issues to work out. Yeah. It's more of, you know, a demonstration of some of the cool things that could be coming down the road.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I could see, for example, if I'm writing one of, you know, something, if I'm the author of part of Win32.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of code there.
Yeah.
This could come really, really useful when I'm trying to debug something. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously.
Yeah. What we like to do is be able to enhance the, and we talked about enhancing the developer's ability to write fast code and secure code. Mm-hmm. Well, everybody introduces bugs into their code, unfortunately. And so one of the skills developers have to have is the ability to understand and react to bugs. We think we can craft an interesting set of tools that can, you know, sort of extend your powers and capabilities. You'd have to do this kind of deduction anyways, and, you know, if it's mechanical like this, the tool can do it for you, then, you know, why not do it?
Outstanding. And this is obviously a good example of the interaction between Visual Studio and Phoenix.
Yes, right.
Who knows, someday the interaction will just be there.
If people want to play with this, it's actually included in our download, so you can get it. It'll add itself into Visual Studio, and you can, you know, it has some limitations. It's not perfect, but you can at least get an idea of what it can do.
Outstanding.
So, and all the sources there, so if you wanted to improve it or enhance it or see what we did, everything is there for you to look at.
Excellent. So let's talk a little bit about that. How much of the source of Phoenix is available?
So we ship the core of Phoenix as a set of managed assemblies.
Mm-hmm.
And then together with that in the SDK, I think there are a total of maybe 20 or 25 sample applications that we ship that then reference those assemblies. And some of these samples are fairly detailed. Like we actually have an entire Pascal compiler.
Wow.
That is shipping as part of a sample. So if somebody's interested in building a language, they could maybe use that as inspiration. And it produces x86 native code. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the code generation part is all handled by Phoenix. The goal of the sample code is actually to generate the Phoenix IARC and then push it through our process to generate the native code.
Very cool.
And I believe in the new one that we're putting out, there may even be a Lisp compiler coming out.
Nice.
So, you know, we're sort of showing people, here's some of the potential things you can do. None of the samples are super polished. None of them are, mm-hmm. You know, going to be something that's necessarily going to become a product, but they really are there to illustrate the potential and the capabilities that are present in Phoenix and things that you can do.
Outstanding.
So.
Well, hey, thank you very much.
Sure.
And the future is bright for compiler.
I think so, yeah.
Compiler world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Outstanding. Well, we'll come back and check on you guys.
Okay, great.
And good luck.
All right.